Accession number 9944, Reel 3.
Mr. Garrod, Reel 3.
Yes, I've been asked about were we suffering from fatigue, notably, but I can't say so. I think I loved it all so much that it was never a factor. But Jan also mentioned that in the summertime, especially up in Scotland, of course, you could read a newspaper almost at midnight, and there was no reason why you shouldn't fly until very late hours. And Ed Hearing, one of our Americans who commanded the unit at Lossiemouth, asked me when I was taking some aeroplane up there from Sherborne whether I'd help him out for a short time, because he had a lot of flying to do and he was short of pilots. And I said yes, arrange it with my CO, with a chap called Victor Cook, and I'd love to help you out. And he did this, and I stayed with him, I think, I forget for how long, I could look in my logbook, 3 or 4 weeks perhaps. We used to be at the Gordon Arms in Elgin, where, in spite of the £5 dinner being the rule in those days, you could get a most wonderful meal. Rationing didn't seem to have affected them up there. And after you'd eaten sometimes, Ed Hearing, sometimes known as Speed Hearing, because he was always active and rushing about, he'd say, come on, Peter, we've got a couple of bullfighters to take up to so-and-so. And you'd find yourself taking off at 8:30 and landing somewhere at 9:30, and you'd be ferried back to Lossiemouth 10:30 or something like that. Wonderful, really, because, of course, the evening can be a beautiful time to fly on a fine evening. But that was mainly up there. Usually we had to be back by dusk, although some of us used to be a little late on occasions.
How many days in a row would you fly over a weekly period?
Well, again, I can look at my logbook. I think in the summertime, if the weather was fine, I forget now how long before your leave came up, but it looks pretty consecutive, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, 25, 27, 28, 29. That's the days of a month in April. I suppose I went to June. You weren't often stopped by weather. Then you'd have your few days leave and carry on again. I'm afraid I used sometimes to ask to fly during my leave. I didn't really feel I needed leave, and there was often jobs to do for pilots. We were, although I think our full strength was just under 1,000, 1944-45, there weren't many occasions when we had surplus pilots.
What was the official attitude to you flying during leave?
Well, I don't think they minded. No, if the operations officer was short of people, he welcomed you. And there was no stop on flying, as far as I remember, if you reached a certain number of hours. Of course, to a commercial airline pilot today, 30, 40 hours a month is probably nothing, because he may do 2 or 3 long hauls of 10 hours each, and he's knocked it up. But you have to remember, we were pretty intensive flying. Some of our flights were in 25, 30 minutes, and we were going through all the procedures of takeoff and landing. So, as a fatiguing experience, there's a factor to be applied to it. Our kind of flying is, of course, much greater than what I've seen as a transatlantic airline pilot. He sits there, the autopilot, going, and has a job to keep himself awake, I believe, occasionally.
How well did the various nationalities within ATA mix?
Oh, very well. Very well, really. We used to joke with the Americans because they were paid much more than we were. And they used to come over and, of course, belittle our country in a quite a good-natured way. And we'd remind them about being former colonials. I can tell you a little story, though, about the Poles, if this would amuse you. Actually, I related at Lynham, where, when I had to give the toast to the Royal Air Force on the recent ATA gathering there. We had some very interesting Poles, escaped from Poland, I suppose, most of them. They weren't always too willing to give you the full story of their background. They had strange names, some of them all consonants and no vowels, you know, you couldn't pronounce. That is like a heavy sneeze. and others with names which we adapted to our own terms. Dougleshevsky, I remember, became Double Whiskey, of course. Nobody called him anything else. And then we had a bunch of lady poles. We had one called Wachelanis. Don't ask me how it was spelt, because we'd pull her leg because you met her in the corridor. We'd give her the old Cockney salute and say, Wachelanis. And they used to get very annoyed about this. They're rather proud of their name, I think, and she used to give her a little stamp of her foot and say, name is not Wachelanis, it's Wachelanis. You know, they didn't like you pulling their leg. And then we had one wonderful Pole I've always remembered, and I related this at Bynum, called Ratomsky, who was a very correct little man. Even when you met him for the fourth or fifth time that day in the corridor somewhere, he'd come to attention, click his heels, give a little bow and say his name, Ratomsky, and he wanted you to know who he was, because it wasn't bad fault. And he was completely bald, absolutely bald, not a hair. And I had the job of trying to make him understand why it was that all the British insisted on calling him Curly. you know, what is this word, Curly? They keep on calling me Curly. What does it mean? And then I couldn't tell him. Our upside-down attitudes to things. No, we got on very well. I was by the Americans, Frenchmen. Arla, I think, was a Frenchman. We had Belgians. We had South Americans. There was a very prominent lady pilot, again, I've forgotten her name, but she's in the book somewhere. I think one of Brazil or Argentina's most prominent civil pilots came over to join us. Began with a C, but I've forgotten her name. Quite a number of nationalities. Yes, we got on fine.
Was there any bad feeling about the Americans' rate of pay?
Not really. I mean, I was too young. I was thought I was very well paid at the time. I've got one of my pay chits somewhere. I looked up the other day. I thought I was very well paid. I mean, our subsistence allowance was £15 a month. I mean, that was gold in those days. When I was living in the mess at Cosford, my mess bill used to come to about 10 shillings. So I was making money hand over fist. Well, in relative terms. Oh, we used to chide the Americans. But then they'd be extremely generous. Chap called Alabama Dunleavy, who you ought to meet too if you're getting a full record of what the ATA Americans were about, he'd be most generous, you know. He'd say, come on, Peter, we're having a party up at the... And he'd take you to somewhere like the Riviera Hotel in Maidenhead. And, I mean, a five-bob dinner may have seemed cheap, but it was quite an item in those days. He'd treat us all because he knew we weren't so well paid. Oh, no, we got on very well indeed. And people like Ed Hearing, for example, I have the highest regard for him. We were a mixed lot, but they were a happy lot, I think.
When you had to stay out overnight, what sort of facilities were there?
Well, you were very frequently at an Air Force station, and there you just stayed in the mess. And I've got some very poignant memories of staying in bomber command messes, of course, and seeing them go, and seeing them come back, or not all of them coming back. And when I saw that film, The Dam Busters, I think they recorded that scene in a way that brought it back to me very, very plainly. I remember standing there in the dusk, and it was exactly the same. They portrayed it there. Very well done. Otherwise, you would stay at hotels. Sometimes, if there was any maintenance unit at some of the airfields we went to, Dumfries, for example, there was no Air Force establishment there. Civilian maintenance unit, they'd put you up in the hotel, run you in, and you're well looked after. Some of the hotels are very nice, even in wartime, they did their best.
What about your status as a civilian pilot when you arrived at an RAF base?
Well, of course, you wore uniform, which I think they got to know, because there'd hardly be an airfield in the country which wasn't visited by ATA in some form or other. No, they accepted us. I never remember a problem over there. Sometimes you'd share a room in a billet, a Quonset hut, what they called, with RAF personnel. That was all they had. And I spent one night in a bomber command station with bomber command men who went out and left almost alone there. And they came in at about 3 or 4 in the morning. But our status, often of interest, because we had often flown aeroplanes they'd love to get their hands on, for example, and sometimes you'd be at some place still flying old bow fighters or something, and you went in because either you were caught out by dusk or some other reason, and a lovely new mosquito. Well, they'd all gather around, what's it like? And they were going to get these in a few months' time. And so there was a lot of interest sometimes in what you were doing. They were very jealous, I suppose, because although 150 of our 800 or 900 lost their lives, I think our chance of survival in the end was much better than theirs. And I mean, I simply can't forget that some of those Bomber Command men, they never reached a tour of 20 missions. They were almost certain to get the chop before then. And we couldn't really compare our lifestyle with theirs.
What about discipline, as you were a civilian organisation?
Well, it was very easy. I mean, I was disciplined for flying offences, as I've told you, aerobatics and so on. But the discipline was... I should think it's very much like a civil airline now. Provided you did the job, turned up on time. I never heard of the heavy hand of discipline having to be enforced at any time if you did your job properly. No, I don't think it was a problem at all.
Can you tell me what happened around the time of D-Day, when things started to
Yes,
change?
Well, I was at Sherburn in Elmet, and I'd heard about this possibility of flying over to the continent, and I was rather keen to do it. Well, my commanding officer wanted me to do four-engine conversion and stay up in Sherburn. But for some reason, which I don't know, I wouldn't quite agree with now, I wasn't too keen to go. I loved highly manoeuvrable aeroplanes. I loved flying fighters and high-powered twin aeroplanes. I'd flown with flight engineers because we had to have them on some of the twin-engine aircraft. I wasn't all that taken with it. So I decided, no, I would forego this four-engine conversion and get down to number one ferry pool where the action was going to be in flying to the continent. And I managed to achieve that. And we went through some special courses because we then started to fly much more in line with what RAF personnel were doing. We had to have dinghies in our parachutes, for example, for crossing the water. We had to do a course in VHF radio because we were constantly flying with radio. Nothing like that had happened to us in our previous ATA flying. And we had to do an instrument flying course because with VHF radio you could be home down to your base and so on through instruments. And the first flight I did was with a chap who was killed, I've forgotten his name, was over to Merville. Great experience for us, not far from Ypres. About five of us took Spitfires over, and we had special money, I think, what would it have been called, Allied Expeditionary Force money or something, and you could go and buy all sorts of various things there that you couldn't get in England. You could get nylon stockings for the girls, and I bought some back from my wife, and she said, oh, they've sold you a duff lot here, they've got no seam up the back. I remember I went back and complained about this. I think we carried pistols, we carried sidearms, or we had the facility of doing it, and we fingered these and told Madam, who sold us these duff silk stockings or nylons, and she protested this is the latest fashion and so on, but we didn't believe her, and she produced some from under the counter which had seams, so all was well. We used to carry chocolate and other stuff, coffee, as bargaining goods for perfume and nylon stockings. And what some of us hadn't realised was that you'd put this coffee in the gun bays, you know, where the ammunition chutes normally went, and they were heated. And I remember the first time we did this, not realising the gun bays was heated, our chocolate was just reduced to a molten, soggy mass all the way over the gun bays. So we got we were told off by the sergeant fitter at the other end that he'd got about 3 hours cleaning up job to do, and of course our chocolate was completely gone. Chocolate was difficult to come by in those days in England, our ration.
How dangerous was it?
Sorry?
How dangerous was it?
I don't think it was dangerous. There were new airfields which we had to find. So, of course, we didn't have the experience of flying in that country like we did over here. I wouldn't have called it dangerous. I did do one or two trips with RAF personnel where we were in cloud a lot of the time. And if the radio had failed, you would have been in trouble. But they were very used to homing you in. They just guided you in. They got you on a radar blip by that time. And, I mean, you never landed in fog or anything, but you sometimes had to break low clouds at a few hundred feet and there was the airfield below you. I took one or two risks with the diver barrage, which was created as a defence against the V1 weapons, a great line of anti-aircraft guns across the whole the Allied occupied territory, the Allied forces. And I'm afraid I went through it once and I got firmly rebuked by that. They tracked me down. I was in a tempest and I assumed they would have known this wasn't a V1, but they said that you can't trust these army gunners. They've been told to fire at anything and they will. So that was a bit of a risk I took, but that was my fault. No, it was quite interesting. We used to bring back quite a few prisoners of war, by the way. And I remember arriving at Brussels and I had to bring back a Mosquito night fighter, which had a little bit of trouble, but I don't think it was the kind of trouble that would have affected its flying condition. It had, I think, a radar problem or something. And there are quite a lot of prisoners of war, British prisoners of war, have been brought to Brussels awaiting repatriation. And I remember on this occasion I brought back this submarine commander in my Mosquito and landed him, because I knew he wanted to get home, some airfield in Leicester very close to his base. And not long ago, by the way, I went to the submarine museum, HMS Alliance at Portsmouth, and got talking to somebody there who ran the record office, and they keep a record of all submarine personnel. And he looked at the chap's card and he noticed he was repatriated on such and such a date, and he's now written on it, flown back by First Officer Garrett, ATA. It's very nice.
What was the state of these British prisoners of war?
Well, that's interesting, because I did, in some other aeroplane, bring back five or six of them. We used to take them to some airfield. I think it was Wing, just north of London. And I'd always tell them when they saw the British coast, you know, the British coast come up. But it made no impression. I think their thoughts were too full. They showed no reaction at all, the ones that I happened to see. This submarine commander was much more alive and aware, you know. He'd, whether because of his training or just his personality, he was most interested and fascinated. But they were, I think, too deep in their own thoughts, and I never got much reaction from them. They looked after them very well at Wing. There were all sorts of people who received them and rehabilitate them and so on. I didn't have much chance to talk to them. Of course, I was flying the aeroplane, but I didn't fly many of those.
When you were in Europe, were you conscious of the fact you might encounter the German line?
I suppose so. I can remember one trip when we went right down to Luxeuil in a group of three. It's actually mentioned in, I think, in Brief Glory or one of the other episodes. They don't attribute it to me, which is wrong, because they put somebody else's name in, but I was definitely there. I led this little flight of three to Luxeuil, where this was just about the time of the breakthrough by the Germans in the Ardennes, and Luxeuil was just to the south of this, and we could hear the gunfire then on landing, and you knew you were pretty close to the front. We were re-equipping a French squadron which tried to fly Thunderbolts, American Thunderbolts, and couldn't get on with them. The Spitfire is a much simpler, more adaptable aeroplane. And I can still remember, it was a beautiful day. We went up high over Luxeuil before we dropped in and saw the whole of the Swiss Alps and end to end. And a very nice experience. And I knew the Alps from pre-war time, done a bit of climbing as a boy, to see them again. Well, you were aware then that you were way up in the front a bit. And then when we used to go to Antwerp and Gilles Orion, the V1s would be going over all day. And on one or two occasions, it was pointed out to me, I was looking at the trail of a V2 rocket going up from Holland, only about 15 miles away, I suppose, and obviously coming down on London somewhere. But I think one of our pilots was caught over Cherbourg when it was held by the Germans after the British or the Allied advance through it, and he was fired at, but I don't think there was any other episode. The only other occasion I can remember, and I can't be sure of it, is that when I was flying near Nottingham once, in and out of, well, just below cloud in rather dirty conditions, I'm sure I saw a Ju-88 whiz by. They didn't fire at me. I think he was probably as alarmed as anything, because I was in a fighter of some sort. I reported it when I got down, but I didn't follow it through. But I think that's about as near as we could say we got to action.
Were you given any shooting training?
Oh, no, no. No. But the only thing that I used to do up in Scotland, if you were flying an aeroplane that was to go overseas, the armament had to be tested, and from a place, I think it was called Tain or Fern up in Scotland, you used to fire bow fighter cannon into the there was an old wreck on the just off the shore. You didn't have to hit it or anything, it was just to make sure the guns worked. I don't quite know why that was. I think these aircraft immediately afterwards were taken out by RAF personnel round Spain and into the Middle East, and I think they wanted to be sure that the guns fired or something. So I used to go up and to fire a few rounds. Very impressive. But that was never in anger. And no, we were civilians, you see. I don't quite know what would have happened if we had landed by mistake in enemy-held territory. Somebody like Letus Curtis might tell you how that was thought through. Because we were civilians, but I think we had to swear to a certain part of the Official Secrets Act. And we obviously held certain official secrets in our minds, even if not officially told about them. It would have been a funny situation, I think. Whether they would have recognised our uniform, I just don't know.
When you went into Europe, were you always given an aeroplane to fly back?
When we went into Europe, no, not always. No, our own Ansons would come out and pick us up. But sometimes you were. Yes, a few Spitfires with bent wings. They'd been over exuberant in a diving attack, Spitfire bombers, and they were the wings had. I think there was a limit to the amount of bend that the wings could take before they were untrustworthy. And a few Spitfires I flew back had the Form 700, which is the sort of official service form, endorsed ferry duties only, wings bent. And we used to fly a lot of Typhoons and Tempests, which had a wonderful engine called the Sabre, which had a very short life and quickly got to the point where it needed a full overhaul. And the indication of this was the oil consumption, which went up to the point where there was no longer sufficient oil to complete a normal flight. You ran down. And these were, if this interests you, this used to amuse me, the aeroplane would be towed to the end of the runway, the downwind end of the runway, where you couldn't taxi it would oil up so quickly. And then you'd start it up, clouds of smoke, of course, ran beautifully smoothly because it was so nicely worn and run in. You'd give it a quick burst of power to make sure it worked properly. A young fitter with a petrol-soaked rag would then leap onto the wing and wipe all the oil off the windscreen, because the whole of the side of the fuselage was smothered in oil. And before the engine had time to oil up, you'd blast off and take off. And provided you did that, it was all right. But then you could only stay airborne for about 30 minutes before you had to be back on the ground, because the oil tank contents would have been exhausted. Flew back quite a few of those.
How did you feel flying over the sea?
Well, you had the dinghy pack in those days. We had dinghy training. We used to go to the swimming pool near White Waltham with our commander. It was Frankie Francis, who was dead now, I'm afraid, which is probably in your annals somewhere. And we all practiced with an Air Force instructor. We used to jump in from the high diving board with our... I forget how they did it, because, of course, your parachute would have been... Yes... I forget, but anyway, you had your dinghy pack on, you had to pull the appropriate things, get into your dinghy, and then you had a kite, I think, you could fly to transmit a radio signal. We were told all about that. I can only remember it was a rotten thing to sit on, because ordinarily on a parachute, on top of it, you had a nice soft cushion, but in the place of that cushion, you had this dinghy, It didn't half dig into you in certain places. But no, I didn't. It was very quick over the sea. I mean, you were thinking like a Spitfire or a Tempest. You were across the English Channel in no time at all. What? You cruised at 300 miles an hour in a Tempest, and 20 miles, you see. So even if you were only 3,000 feet, you probably almost had enough momentum to carry you to the far side if you had engine failure. Didn't you always used to think, as many pilots do, that the engine note changed crossing the sea, only because their senses are sharpened, I think. You read Jim Mollison, who was one of our pilots, by the way, used to know him fairly well. He'd always tell you, as he on his record flights, as he crossed the coast, the engine would almost sound a little bit different. And I think you did notice that, but I never had any worries at all.
How important was it that you'd had the radio course?
Oh, it was essential, I think, because you were controlled entirely by the VHF radio network, which was fully established by that time. I forget if it was compulsory to call and clear your way through, but certainly, you see, you couldn't get proper weather reports over there and so on. We used to do practice homers. I remember, I think it was Lasham or Odium, which was 83-84 support group airfields over here. And we were really flying on behalf of the Air Force 83-84 group. We used to do practice homers to make sure that if we did get over the other side into any difficulty, we could do a proper homing procedure, which was a bit of a procedure. You had to go through the right processes of being talked down. Gave you confidence in them, too.
Did you... You were flying into previously enemy-held bases.
Oh, yes. I mean, Gilsa Ryan, where I spent a lot of time in a Courtrai, Gilsa Ryan was built by the Germans, a very nicely constructed camp, a bit smashed up by the time we got there. But if that was the standard of German RAF, the German Air Force establishment, it was pretty good. This was built in Dutch territory, of course. But I spent a lot of... Gilsa Ryan, I don't know, that was spelled G-I-L-Z-E, R-I-J-E-N, I think, and others thereabouts. I've forgotten their names. I'm looking at the logbook. We used to take aircraft and spend the night there. They were quite well constructed.
What about facilities for staying the night?
Well, a lot of our flying was to Brussels. We there used to go to the transit camp, which I think was the old Metropole Hotel, and you'd be given vouchers for meals, and food was good. You go and do a bit of trade with your chocolate if you had it, and your other bits and pieces, your coffee in exchange for perfume and so on. There was a cinema there, the principal cinema in Brussels had been given over to the British forces. Some enterprising sergeant had found some German blue films which he used to put on, which were a great success. And one or two bawdy places like the hole in the wall that some of the others might remember, which I won't tell you all the things that used to go on there. They're too shocking, but of course we thought we were great lads, you know, the conquering forces, although we rarely weren't any part of the conquering. We used to go in and enjoy ourselves in Brussels quite a lot.
What about the local population?
Well, they were very friendly in Brussels. In fact, I remember in the Metropole there was a large section of the wall covered with invitations. I think a lot of them perhaps had the idea of striking up a useful commercial relationship, but I don't know quite what they expected of us, because small parcels of coffee and so on weren't all that easy to come by in England. And but they used to invite you out for meals, and a few of us used to take advantage of that. I think they were genuinely pleased to see you. I don't know about Paris. I went to Paris once or twice, but Brussels and Antwerp. Brussels was remarkable. I think a whole lot of its wealth had been stored up in the Congo. You probably, other people will know much more about this than I do, and I think it was beginning to be returnable to Brussels after it had been liberated, and they seemed to be doing quite well, the Belgians, very soon after occupation. Somehow they'd obtained the accumulated wealth that was due to them through their Congo relationship. I think a very wealthy colony for them.